Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Webster's Dictionary defines the word poem as, quote, a composition in verse, especially a highly developed, imaginative one, characterized by great beauty of language or expression, end quote. While our nation has had some great poets, the art form has not enjoyed the kind of wide popularity it has in many other cultures. Why is that? Does it matter? If so, can anything be done about it? Tammy Holland has some thoughts about this. She's Montana's poet laureate. Tammy, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. I'm really happy to be here.
What's your background? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up on the High Line. There was a little town called Inverness. I don't think it's even on the map anymore so much. And I grew up 20 miles south of there, near the Marias River. So it was an entirely rural existence. We had to ride the bus 40 minutes to school every day. And on weekends, there were some cousins and friends around. We would go for these long hikes. Our imaginations were, you know, free to roam around the prairie.
Farming family?
Farming family, yes.
What kind of farm?
Wheat farm. We had some animals as well, but mostly wheat. And so they put me in a truck for the first time to drive it down the field when I was 8 years old.
Yeah, those are the kind of experiences you get in rural life that
yeah.
are hard to duplicate. Education?
Well, after I graduated high school, I went to Missoula, and I went straight through a bachelor's program and into a master's program there in English literature. And then I taught, I did a variety of things, and then I went off to Bennington College to get my MFA in creative writing, and that was a low residency program. That was a little later in life.
So where does poetry begin to come into this story from the time that you're out walking with friends and your imagination is taking off? Where's poetry?
I turned to poetry pretty early, and I don't know why. It's not like my house was full of poetry. But I started writing it when I was 12-ish, mm-hmm. somewhere around in there. But what I did grow up with was music. My father played instruments, my brother, various other people in the family. There would be these long jam sessions in the evenings. In the 40s, my dad was in had a dance band, and he also painted in oils. And so images and music were a huge part of my early life. I just took them for granted. And I think somehow those two came together in poetry, which actually contains both.
And when did you start, let's say you started at 12 writing poetry, when did it become something more than casual for you?
I went off to Missoula thinking I would be a poet. Now, I was not very good at any of it at that point, and you know, would have benefited from early instruction, I'm sure. But nevertheless, that was an early goal. And then I quit, and I switched to fiction for a while. But that's how it reemerged as poetry.
Let me go back to something you just said. I think you said that there's a lot of similarity between poetry, music, and images, painting. Is that what you said?
Exactly, yes.
My sense is, as a culture, a lot of us don't see that. In other words, poetry is sort of the three. People would say painting. Yes, I can understand painting. Music is music. I got it. Poetry is seen as sort of separate, for the elite, hard to understand. Do you agree or disagree with that? My sense, that's a broadly held perception in our culture.
You know, it could very well be. I do often hear from people that they don't understand poetry, so they don't read it. Or even that they hate poetry. In the classroom, when that comes up, I just ask, does anybody in here hate poetry? And people will raise their hands. I say, that's fine, and that's where we're going to start, and we'll work from there. But in truth, poetry uses all kinds of sonic devices on the surface.
And sonic as in sound?
Sound devices, yes. I mean, repetition of sounds. Certain sounds can be short and hard. And other sounds can go on for a long time, right? And those things help to create the music. And when they're repeated, then you take them in, you're not necessarily conscious of them. This is the same thing that happens with music. And so poems can affect your mood in the way music can. Similarly, though we work in language, we're often building images with our language. Mm-hmm. And in that way, it has similarities to visual art. In fact, there's a whole, historically from, some of the earliest examples appear in the ancient epics. There's a kind of poetry we call ekphrastic, which is sort of a...
Say that again?
Ekphrastic.
Ekphrastic, that's a new word for me.
Sort of a complicated Greek word. But what it means is poetry based on visual art. We see a painting, we respond to it with words.
That's an interesting idea. Can you give me an illustration of what you mean in verse?
Sure. This is a poem by Robert Hayden, who was a consultant to the Library of Congress in the 70s, the equivalent of the Poet Laureate of the United States. And this poem is called Sunday Morning, and I'll just recite the first few lines. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue, black cold. Then with hands that ached from weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him.
I've interviewed different teachers and we've done subjects on different art forms. I've never heard anybody say, students commonly say, I hate so-and-so, like I hate music. You don't hear that. I hate painting. I hate poetry. Suggests something. What does it suggest to you and how do you get around that?
Well, I don't think they actually hate it. I think they fear that they can't understand it. And oddly, we don't do this with other art forms, as you say. I mean, we never say, I hate fiction, and yet some fiction is highly complex and very difficult to understand.
Right. So that suggests to me that some people are intimidated by the idea of poetry.
Right.
How do you get around it? You're a teacher.
I just teach them about poetry. And for one thing, I also accept where they're coming from. If they say they hate it, then fine. And then we'll look at it. And actually, I often start with that Robert Hayden poem because at the end of that poem, they all recognize the regret in that speaker's voice. And they recognize it because of the way the poem is put together. And so we learn about that. And they nod their heads, and it's a little bit like listening to a song. We get past the hatred pretty fast.
We jumped a little fast forward. I said you're a teacher. Tell me about what level you've taught poetry at, what forums.
Well, I teach at Montana State University, Billings. I teach at various levels there. I've taught at the Montana Women's Prison for 5 years.
Poetry at the Montana Women's
Taught poetry, creative writing more generally, literature. Mm-hmm. And I have also done workshops for students. I did a workshop for a first grade class once, and at various stages all through elementary school, mm-hmm. junior high school, and adult education as well.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Montana's Poet Laureate, Tammy Holland. In your experience, let's start with age, younger kids versus college kids. Any difference in terms of openness, attitude, receptivity?
Yes. Younger kids they're in the midst of just a great imaginative part of their lives. And they haven't been discouraged yet from letting their imaginations just roam wildly. So that's a great place to be for poetry. They're also very much, they're active physically. How they're learning is through play and physical activity. And poetry is dependent on the senses in many ways. So one thing I do with older people is try to get them back to their senses. What do you smell? What do you see? What do you hear? What does this surface feel like? What do you feel like when you're sad? Where do you locate that in your body?
How interesting. So in a way, you're trying to put them back into a childhood frame of reference.
Or... Absolutely, yes. Part of it is sensory, and part of it also is that as we get older, we get more self-conscious about our mistakes, and we don't like to make mistakes. And the nature of writing is that you will make mistakes, and you've got to get in there, and you've got to play, and be willing to experiment. And that's part of the fun of it, and it's part of It's where the good ideas come from. We all have a kind of surface rational part of us, but the deepest part of us is less accessible unless we're willing to play and explore.
Now, someone might say, let's say I'm a college student. I've got a heck of a workload. I'm trying to get a degree. I've got carrying my student loans. I might play table tennis. I might dance, but I really don't have time for play. You know, this sounds pie in the sky, outside my life, my pressured life. What do you say to somebody like that? Do you run into that?
Yeah, I do. Well, mostly if they sign up for a class, they're willing to play.
Okay.
but sure I do. And then we just go ahead anyway. You know, 10 minutes of writing freely and wildly is not going to hurt anybody.
The implication there is that somebody who might have that pressured outlook on life, you can break through and get them to have that other experience.
Right. And I do that even in basic writing classes, composition classes. The first thing we start out with is this discussion of their willingness to experiment, and then we do what we call free writing. And I think probably most compositions teachers do this, where I just say, okay, the rule is you put your pen to paper and you write, and you stop when I say stop, and I don't care what hits the page. And it loosens them up. It helps build fluency in language. It helps them release tensions. It helps them in all kinds of ways. And this is a kind of basic activity that can be developed then and turned into poetry eventually in other classes.
All right, let's shift from the student to someone who's listening to this show. They work for a living. They work hard. They come home. They're tired. Maybe they might be willing to read some poetry, but I want to ask you about whether you think it's practical or not to encourage people to actually try to write some. And if so, what do you say to them about breaking through to a different place and trying it? Is that just ridiculous?
No. You know, we don't hold ourselves back from singing in the shower or, experimenting with our cooking.
I was interested. You mentioned your dad, a farmer,
right,
was a painter. I mean,
right.
He liked to put oil to...
Yes.
Canvas.
Yes, exactly. I don't think we should hold back those creative energies. And
Why? What difference does it make?
I think they're fundamental to humanity. I think that it's been part of our human nature for as long as humans have been humans. We have cave paintings, an oral tradition of storytelling and poetry that precedes anything that's been written down in the last 4,000 years. Music is universal. I mean, these are the things that really express who we are as humans. The other thing I could say there, you know, my dad was Scandinavian, and in the Scandinavian tradition, you don't make these distinctions like poetry is for the upper class and the farmers are just farmers. Everybody can kind of work across these arts and be a laborer in one way or another or a worker in one way or another. I think there are some other traditions where there's more of a hierarchy. And the English tradition is like that. You know, there are discussions that Shakespeare could not possibly have done what he did because he wasn't upper class. And I don't know. I think that's... I don't believe much in that argument.
It's an interesting thing just to take Shakespeare, because clearly the audiences that Shakespeare wrote for were everyday people.
Exactly.
And were able to understand what we now say is probably or perhaps the greatest poetry ever written. It's certainly at that level, which challenges the assumption that I think is part of our culture in some places that poetry is for the quote-unquote elite. I was struck some years ago, I think I was interviewing someone involved in the Farmers Union, and they told me that they, in the Depression, there were poetry readings at the annual Farmers Union conference.
I don't doubt that at all. Some decades back, there were poems in the newspaper every time it came out.
So what's going on? Is it television and that's changing, making us more passive? You don't see much poetry in the newspaper, I'll put it that way. You don't see, poetry is hard to get published in book form in terms of the market. What's happening?
Right, and it might be, you know, it might be because of the market, you know, because everything is supposed to be saleable. I don't really know what that is. I think as we become more technologized, we kind of thin ourselves out.
What do you mean?
I mean, some of the depth of the culture gets lost, and instead we're concerned with the quickness of the culture and what's new today and how much we can keep up and what's current, as opposed to really respecting the historical traditions. Poetry is coming back to the newspaper through American Life and Poetry. Ted Kooser, one of our former poet laureates, actually set up that program, and it's been fantastic. If you when poems appear on American Life and Poetry, anybody can post them on blogs or newspapers anywhere, and they believe that they have approximately 3 million readers and from 72 countries who look at those poems.
Let's talk about your experience teaching women in prison literature and poetry. That's from an outsider's perspective, one might say, that's got to be a tough audience. Folks are having problems. They've committed crimes. They're in there. They're not going to be particularly receptive to, quote, art, end quote. What's your experience?
I think it's just the opposite, actually. And the really interesting thing about prison is that it is still a handwritten culture.
What do you mean?
Well, there's no internet. People are not sending emails back and forth. Hmm. People are still writing letters by hand to each other, and they're reading because while they do have television, there's not much else in the way of entertainment. So many of these women are serious readers. So that aspect of it, I think, makes it very favorable. The other thing that happens is that some people have, for example, not finished high school, and have perhaps been told that they're not very good as students or not very capable. Mm-hmm. And so you do have to break through that lack of confidence. But again, a few exercises is often all it takes. In my very first class, I was teaching literature and creative writing, and initially they said, "We don't know anything about this. We don't know what you're talking about." I said, "That's fine. We're just going to move forward." And we started by just reading aloud. And one person refused to read aloud because she was told that she wasn't a good student. And I put dictionaries on the table, and pretty soon she was our dictionary person. She'd look up words, and pretty soon she was reading aloud. And once they got a handle on poetry, this very person I'm mentioning to you, this person who felt she could not even read aloud, began to think of herself as a poet. And that became her primary mode of expression in all the subsequent classes.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Montana's poet laureate, Tammy Holland. That's quite a striking story about that young woman. Is she really exceptional in her responsiveness to that opening, or is it your experience that women in prison generally find a meaningful response to that?
There were many students who were just so grateful for these classes and grateful to be able to write what they felt and what they thought. I think it's far more common than we might imagine without.
It's very interesting to me. And as I think about it, I've done several shows in prison and in a previous life spent time involved in corrections. And as I think about it, it makes perfect sense. If someone is potentially open to exploring their hard experience, this could be a very interesting way and meaningful way to do it, and very personal.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, I worked with a couple of therapists inside the prison, and we had a creative writing therapy course. And so then we had very directed exercises. We would ask them to write about a particularly painful experience, to imagine what might be in the future. One that I can think of was a point of view exercise. So we said, write about this bad thing that happened to you, mm-hmm. not from your own perspective, but as if you're writing from outside of yourself. And one woman chose to write about domestic violence. She was a victim of domestic violence from the point of view of a turtle painting on the wall. She called it "If Turtle Can Talk," or "If Turtle Could Talk." And that gave her the distance to allow her to really examine what had happened in her life. And we found that often, that if we allowed them to step outside of themselves and write from that perspective, they could see things and speak about things that they couldn't speak about otherwise.
If memory serves, you were designated by the governor in 2013 as Poet Laureate, correct?
Yep.
What's that forum enabled you to do?
Well, my job is to advocate, to promote poetry in the state. And so sometimes communities will ask me in. I'm willing to do, all kinds of things, to go to communities and talk about how they might set up literary programming, how they might bring other poets in, what they might do over time to introduce poetry into their schools, for example.
All right, let's take any one of those, and let's say I'm on the school board. Talk to me. What do you say to me that makes that idea real and practical and appealing to me?
Well, we've talked about the expressiveness of poetry, that it allows people to say things that are on their mind. So if we give children this opportunity, then they're able to know that they can express themselves in this way. And when we work with children, and this is not true just of me, but you know, I think all of us who work with children in writing programs, we teach them a little bit about a poem, we give them time to write, we allow them to read their poems aloud and to listen to each other carefully, all of this in a span of an hour. So they get multiple lessons from that experience and a great, you know, confidence builder as well.
Okay, I'm still on the school board, and in my case, in real life, I don't think I'm much of a poet. I understand the conceptual benefits to the students that I'm responsible for as a school board member, but what do I do? How do I find poets to bring into the school, our school here, our elementary school? We're in rural Montana. Who do I call?
You could look at Humanities Montana. You could look at the Speakers Bureau.
What's the Speakers Bureau?
The Speakers Bureau is a list of many, many people around the state, writers, poets, historians, scholars who are willing to travel anywhere and
come to my school.
Come to your school and provide a presentation for your students. And Humanities Montana has the funding to support this process. So it's really quite simple in that respect. And you can Google Speakers Bureau, Humanities Montana, and there's the listing of everybody who's available.
I understand that part, that I might be able to get a poet or a writer to come in. Are there resources that someone could come in like yourself and teach our third graders or second graders or fourth graders, give them the experience of trying to write poetry, not just listen?
Absolutely. That's on my list in the Speakers
okay.
Bureau, things that I can do.
Got an email address that
and
you
that
want to share?
And my email is there, thaaland@msubillings.edu.
Just in role-playing as a rural school board member, something occurred to me that I'd like to get your sense for. Our country is now about 80-20 urban. It started out 90-10 rural. Over time, that transition, I think, has affected the perceptions of rural people and perhaps urban people that rural is, quote, behind the times. It's not part of the trend. Does the fact that rural people now are in a small minority in any way affect outreach to rural communities in the arts and specifically in poetry, in your experience?
Honestly, I don't know. I hate to stereotype urban and rural.
Okay.
I think we're at risk doing that. I think one thing that's difficult in Montana is simply the distance that we have to travel. And, some of the more rural communities have great arts communities. When I was a kid growing up on the High Line, Chester had this fantastic arts council. It's where I saw my first opera when I was 16 because the Calgary Opera came down. And they still have a strong arts council. I think it has more to do with what communities, how they perceive themselves. And I guess it's nice for any community to think in terms of what can we do to improve the arts in our community, our access to arts.
It's an interesting thing, you know, when I think about rural art, cowboy poetry is a well-recognized art form, and obviously, by definition, it's rural. And your poetry that I've read, some of it is very rural. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's true, yes.
Why don't you give us an example of that?
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, I started in the grain truck when I was 8. So here's a little poem called A Colander of Barley. The smell, once water has rinsed it, is like a field of ripe grain, or the grain held in a truck. And if you climb the steel side, one foot lodged on the hubcap, the other on the wheel, and pull your body upward, your hands holding to tarp hooks, and lift toes onto the rim of the truck box, rest your ribs against the side, you will see beetles and grasshoppers among the hulled kernels. Water stirs and resurrects harvest dust, sun beating on abundance, the moist heat of grain collected in steel, hands plunging and lifting, the grain spilling back.
As I listened to you read that, it took me back very vividly into climbing into the back of a truck.
Good. I'm glad. That was my hope, I guess, on
well,
some level.
Your term as a poet laureate is 2 years?
Yes.
How's it going? What so far has happened that's meaningful to you?
It's going well. There are some really exciting things happening, I think. We had our first Poets Congress at Big Sky, and I teamed up with Colorado's Poet Laureate, Dave Mason, and we put together a show that was all poetry in their Warren Miller Performing Arts Center. And so that was really exciting to bring in poets from around the state and include everybody and different kinds of poetry together for an audience.
What kind of audience?
It was primarily young people and their parents.
About how many people?
Maybe 150, maybe a few more.
That's a pretty good crowd.
It was a great crowd.
At the end of your term, what do you want to be able to do when you look back and say, I accomplished this?
I really hope that I've encouraged communities to bring some of the many talented poets and writers in our state into their towns, into their theaters, their high schools, their elementary schools, and allow their community to connect with these people and hear their words.
Poet Laureate Tammy Holland, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.